So you have black holes entering each other's event horizons. It's an extraordinary disturbance in the fabric of space and time. And it turns out there is a path you can take around two moving black holes where you can end up in the past of when you started that journey.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is Thursday, or is it Wednesday? Wait, I forgot what day it is. I can't even remember. I think it's Thursday, right? It is Thursday. Yes, they're telling me it is Thursday. Seems like it should be Friday by now, but I guess it is Thursday. It is the 16th of June, 2016, and welcome to another edition of The Opening Bell. Welcome to another business day. Glad to have you along. Lots to talk about today. You heard Roger there tell you about the markets around the world after the big interest rate announcement yesterday from Janet Yellen. All of the European indices are lower. The Asian indices as well hit hard overnight. The Nikkei off almost 3%. The Hang Seng off about 2%. European markets hit as well. Not as bad, though. Off almost 1% in some instances. And as you might imagine, the Dow futures pointing in the wrong direction this morning, looking for a lower open on Wall Street. Is it because of Janet Yellen? Is it because of the interest rates? Is it because of Brexit? What's going on in the world? We'll try to answer that for you as we move through the morning. But first, let's go over what Janet Yellen said yesterday. The Federal Reserve, as we expected, hit the pause button. The central bank decided not to raise interest rates. And Janet Yellen, during a almost two-hour-long, hour-and-a-half-long news conference, talked about the decisions ahead and the forecast for the growth in 2016, now 2%, down from 2.2% earlier. Here is Yellen talking to reporters about what might lie ahead and what was behind the decision.
If the data, incoming data, were in the coming months to justify the kind of gradual increases that we've long discussed that we see is appropriate in light of the outlook. I think markets should not be surprised by such a decision if we make it, and it's obviously consistent with the data that we've seen, and the committee will feel free to move in the coming months if we think it's appropriate.
If you remember, at the beginning of the year, the Fed governors were very serious about raising rates several times. They said they were going to do it in March. Then they said they were going to do it in June. One analyst says the economy around the world, especially here at home, is underwhelming at best, and that's what's driving the decision. Janet Yellen was asked, this is an election year, the idea of possibly raising interest rates later this year as we get closer to the election. Is that something that's going to impact a decision?
We are very focused on assessing the economic outlook and making changes that are appropriate without taking politics into account.
Any movement in interest rates obviously impacts millions of Americans, not to mention the global economy. Mortgage rates will move higher. Debt for credit cards and car loans get more expensive. Savers benefit because they earn a little bit more interest on their deposits. A rate hike generally is a sign that the economy is closer to full health. Yellen did say we are closer to full employment in the country, but she stopped short of saying we were at full health in the United States. Again, markets so way lower this morning, significantly lower in Asia. We'll continue to follow this throughout the morning. One, a couple of other quick headlines. Walmart stores cutting jobs, announcing today they're going to be laying off almost 1,500 people around the country, across the country. And also today, the union representing workers at Macy's in New York City are in talks. They may actually walk off the job today, probably will walk off the job in a strike at Macy's, again, the flagship store in New York. Let's listen to the universe. And that's not a bird outside of your window. Those are gravitational waves. They've been recorded for a second time by a group of scientists, including a group of scientists right here in the Chicago area, Northwestern University, University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana involved as well. Let's bring in Shane Larson this morning, a research associate professor at Northwestern University. Shane, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Thank you. It's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
We're glad to have you. This is an exciting thing because when people, I think there were some people who, when they saw this first discovery of gravitational waves, says, I don't know. What does your team's hearing it a second time mean?
Well, I think all of us in the collaboration are really excited that we've made the second detection, and it's come so soon after the first detection. There's a lot of things that are really exciting about this event, not the least of which is that there have been two. As astronomers, we know that the thing that we're doing is looking at the universe and trying to detect and characterize the things we're interested in this case, these black holes and very strongly gravitating systems. And the fact that we've now seen two means that this is really astronomy. We're really looking and trying to understand the universe, and we're going to see more than one event. It wasn't just a once-off. It wasn't just a one-time thing. This is really astronomy, and there's going to be many more things that happen, many more things that LIGO detects in the future, and this will become a regular tool that we as astronomers use to study the universe.
We'll get into some of the nuts and bolts after. We have to check traffic here, but I want to ask you first before that. I love the way that some of your colleagues have described this as, you know, we've opened a window to the universe and we're listening and we're hearing these things. When you open a window, when you look into the sky, generally you hear and see things. This is a big deal, isn't it?
This is really a big deal. I often tell people this is as important as any of the biggest, most important discoveries you hear about in astronomy, because this is a completely new way of probing and understanding the universe. We're very used to, you know, the Hubble Space Telescope and using telescopes to detect things that are going on. And this is a completely separate and different way of characterizing, you know, stars and black holes and strongly gravitating systems. So it has new information, different information. It will produce new answers and new questions about the cosmos that we've never had before.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now, investors stretched their losing streak to five sessions as stocks sank late on Wednesday after the Federal Reserve left interest rates unchanged. The Dow Jones, which had been up more than 55 points, ended the day down 35. The S&P 500 fell nearly 4. The NASDAQ lost 8. Walmart is cutting about 1,500 back-office jobs across 500 of its stores. Bookkeeping will now be moved to Walmart's home office, and cash counting at stores will be done by machine. The people who had done those jobs will be offered customer service positions. Chinese ride-hailing service Didi Chuxing says it's raised over $7 billion from investors, adding to an intensifying rivalry in China with Uber. Investors in the latest round of financing include China Life Insurance Company and Apple. The union that represents workers at Macy's flagship store in New York City say contract talks are continuing, but that if no agreement is reached, a strike could come later today. Issues include health care, unpredictable schedules, and pension plans for senior employees. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the program, 521. A big announcement yesterday from scientists around the world that they had heard gravitational waves for a second time, including scientists from Illinois, from Northwestern, and the University of Illinois. Here's part of the announcement yesterday.
Observing run. So why is this important? Why do we need Virgo? And why do we, in fact, need a network of gravitational wave detectors? Well, I'll tell you that in the next slide, but let me just point out that in addition to the two LIGO detectors and Virgo, we also have a detector that's under construction by colleagues of ours in Japan that's called the Kagra detector, which will be running at the end of this decade. And then we've recently gotten permission by
one of the scientists yesterday at the American Astronomical Society, Shane Larson at Northwestern University, on with us this morning. Shane, I believe that's one of your former colleagues, is it not?
Yeah, that was Dave Reitze speaking. He's our executive director at LIGO and a Northwestern alum.
Well, there's a couple of questions I want to start off with, and that is first, you know, we opened the broadcast with the sound of the bloop, bloop. What were we hearing there?
So the waves, the signals that we get from these systems, these black holes, are not waves that your body is designed to detect. You don't have a gravitational wave sensor built into your body. So LIGO detects these waves, and we have this pile of data, and we think about how do you show that? How do you represent that to people? And as it turns out, the numerical size and shape of those waves is exactly the numerical size and shape of the waves that your ear is capable of hearing. So we simply take that data and we push it out through a headphone jack, and it turns it into a sound that you're capable of hearing. And so it's just a different way of representing the data rather than drawing a graph or something like that. So we call that the chirp because of the way it sounds to your ear.
So we have an audience full of people who do numbers all day long, mostly stock market numbers. Tell them why this is important to us and them.
So there's a lot of interesting reasons why we think this kind of effort is important. There are good societal reasons because, you know, the money that we spend on these experiments and the technology that comes out of them goes directly back into society. You know, we spent a lot of money designing big laser systems and computer systems capable of interpreting this data. And all of that comes and goes back into our normal everyday lives in different and remarkable ways. From the astronomy point of view, this is important because this is a long-standing bit of science from physics that we've been trying to understand. It's taken us 100 years to build an experiment that's capable of making these detections. And that kind of tenacity is the kind of thing that you need in science to make big discoveries and train young scientists and kind of push the whole field forward. So there's lots of reasons we think it's important.
You're right, because it's sort of the moonshot all over. Again, the moonshot.
Yeah, just like that. Yeah,
it inspired a whole generation of young people to become scientists, and the things that were built for the moon program and for space, those are the things that we use every day. So there's, I guess, the idea that the notion that as we learn more things, our lives will become more technical, perhaps. But from just a basic standpoint, I heard somebody say, when we listen, we hear things, we know how to hear things, and maybe we find other stuff. What else could we find?
So in terms of astronomy, there are different things that we could discover besides these black holes. So black holes are just the beginning. They're the biggest, strongest gravitating things you can imagine. But we expect we'll see supernova explosions if they happen in the Milky Way. We expect we'll see neutron stars, which are another kind of stellar skeleton, if they happen in the Milky Way. But then, you know, the thing that we were just talking about societal implications, you know, this is all part of something that we call general relativity. And that was a description of gravity that Einstein invented a century ago. And as it turns out, every single one of us uses general relativity every day. It's built into the phone navigation system, the GPS, in everyone's smartphone. So when you're using your phone to walk around town to find an ice cream or a coffee shop, you're using general relativity every single day. And that's a consequence of the kinds of science that we're using today.
And people don't realize, when you mention the word supernova, if, you know, a star goes supernova close to us, we could be toast. I don't think people understand that, right?
Yeah, that's right. You know, when you hear about supernovas, they're so intensely bright that we can see them from far across the universe. And every supernova you've ever heard of has been far, far away. But historically, there have been supernovas in the Milky Way. The most famous is the one that created the Crab Nebula, which is an object you can see from a telescope in your backyard. When it went off, it was visible during the daytime, and you can read by it at night for like a month. But, you know, it didn't hurt us on Earth because it was so far away, but it was so intensely bright that if it had been closer, we would have been toast.
Yeah. I want to ask you, because, I mean, I could talk to you all hour, but we're running out of time, unfortunately. But I wanted to ask you, this past week or the week before, we heard from scientists that 80% of humanity can no longer see the Milky Way from Earth. Talk to me about the significance of that.
So the reason for that is our obsession with light at night. You know, we're very visual beings, our society, and we like to be able to see and you know, go about our lives, whether it's daytime or nighttime. And the consequence of that is that the way we use light at night is not effective in terms of what we need it for. It's not just projected down at the ground. It's projected up at the sky as well, and that makes it almost impossible for people to see stars. And that's certainly something we experience here in Chicago a lot. If you go out at night, there's only a few stars you can see at much. But if you go out to the countryside here in Illinois, you find that there are indeed thousands of stars, and you can see the Milky Way. And our study is showing is that we all live in cities, and so you're losing that contact with the universe. You're losing that contact with the night sky just simply because we never see the stars, and that's a great tragedy. I grew up in the country, and I'm used to seeing that, and it makes me very sad that, you know, my friends and the people I encounter here in Chicago who have grown up in the city and never been out to the country don't get to see it the way I did when I was growing up.
Shane Larson, Northwestern University, also Adler Planetarium, a research associate professor at Northwestern University Center for Interdisciplinary Exploration and Research in Astrophysics.
It's a mouthful.
It is. Thank you for being with us. Congratulations to you and your team.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being on.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. It is 5:38 as our conversation continues this morning. We turn our attention to net neutrality. The U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has issued a ruling in the past week on net neutrality, upholding the FCC's rules on this that were challenged by some of the internet companies. The court ruling is seen as perhaps the final word, but maybe this could go to the Supreme Court. At issue is just the very internet we all use and who can oversee that. The FCC, the Federal Communication Commission, claims that it can, and that's what the court has apparently ruled. Let's bring in James Spetta at Northwestern University. He is a law professor who specializes in telecommunications law. Professor Spetta, let's start first just by giving folks who may not be technically apt and know this, what net neutrality is.
Net neutrality is the idea that the company that provides your internet access service, whether it's your cable company, your cell phone company, or AT&T, should be neutral or not discriminate between the content and application providers that you access over that internet service.
So give us an example of what that means.
Well, at one extreme, it would mean, could your cable provider from whom you get internet block your access to the New York Times or to the Wall Street Journal if they didn't like the opinions being offered by those newspapers? At a somewhat less extreme level, could your cable company slow down the performance of Netflix on your internet connection so that you'd be more likely to, say, rent a video from their video on demand collection?
And so there had been no regulation of this before, is that correct? And the FCC decided it was time to jump in?
There had been no regulation for this up until a few years ago when the FCC did take some action in a particular case against Comcast. This is actually the third time the case has been to the Court of Appeals in which it had reviewed various attempts by the FCC to enact regulations in this space.
And so the appeals court has ruled on this, and it seems like a pretty solid ruling. First of all, tell us what the ruling is and then what you think of it.
So there were two important aspects to this ruling. The first of which was, did the FCC have authority under the statute to impose non-discrimination requirements on the internet access providers by describing those internet access providers as similar to old-fashioned telephone companies? And the court held that the FCC did have that authority. The second question that was presented to the court was, is this good policy, even if the FCC has authority to do so? The court reviewed the FCC's decision, and under the standard of review in which the court defers to the agency's policy judgment, decided that the agency had sufficient reasons to adopt the non-discrimination policy called net neutrality.
So depending on the news you read about this, there's some that say this is a loss for these companies, a win for consumers. Some say it's just the opposite. What is it? Let's talk about it first from the company's standpoint. This is a loss for them, and they, what, perhaps had plans to do what you just explained they might have done?
The FCC's regulations were very vigorously challenged by the cable companies and the phone companies that provide internet access. And they argued that these regulations would interfere with their ability to do creative business models and to raise the funds that are necessary to build out the records, the networks. And so from the perspective of those companies who challenge this regulation, it's definitely a loss.
At a very bare bones, at the very basic level, this was a question. There were lots of questions about whether the FCC could even regulate the internet, that it didn't have the same, you know, the right to oversee it as, let's say, a television company or something like that. Was that the first argument that some of the companies put forward?
That was the first argument. The very first argument was the scope of the FCC's authority over the internet. And in a previous case, this same court had said that the FCC did have some authority over the internet, but that authority was limited unless the FCC were willing to say that the internet functioned as a communication service similarly to old-fashioned telephone service. So what the FCC had done in this case is to take another look at the internet and to decide that the communication services now being offered by broadband or internet providers are so similar to telephone service that the FCC's maximum regulatory authority under the statute could be brought to bear.
How much of an impact did third-party internet content have on this? I know one of the judges wrote about that specifically in the ruling.
So I think that the third-party internet content and the third-party internet companies were a very significant part of the case. And they were, of course, the reason that the FCC adopted the rules was a concern that cable companies would discriminate against these third-party unaffiliated providers. And so the court accepted that argument from the FCC as the justification for these rules. And I described earlier this case as a loss for companies like the cable company and the telephone company, but it's a win for other big companies. It's a win for Netflix. It's a win for Amazon. It's a win for Google and YouTube and companies like that that provide content and services over the internet.
Because those are those third-party providers. A lot of us have internet service with one company and then use all of that other stuff. We've already seen some of the throttling, I guess is what they call it, with Netflix. That company was caught doing that. So there is a precedent for companies taking advantage of this, right?
There was some precedent. There were a few incidents. One of the factual questions at the FCC was how likely were those sorts of discriminatory practices, but the FCC evaluated the history and evaluated the incentives of the companies and said that it was worried enough about those sorts of incidents that it justified the regulation.
We see federal regulators and consumer groups hailing this ruling, but there's also some concern that whenever you have one of these rulings, it's going to end up costing consumers. Do you think that might be the case here in some way?
The argument from the carriers, and the argument has some plausibility, is that their inability to offer innovative business models where they charge additional fees to content providers will cause them to have to charge consumers more for the building out and upgrading of broadband networks. We haven't seen a lot of evidence of that, but it's too soon to tell exactly what the effects of the regulation will be.
And some are very critical of the FCC for not tackling this sooner. They came really late to the game. Is that a valid argument?
Some have criticized the FCC for being late to the game. My own view is that the FCC was appropriately cautious as the internet developed, appropriately cautious as broadband became more widely available and these services developed. I mean, you and I and many of us live in a way that is very reliant on the broadband internet. But it's amazing to think that just 20 years ago, there was no such thing. So I think the FCC was appropriately cautious and then acted when it thought it had sufficient record to do so.
And pending any further court challenges, it seems like the FCC has laid its claim and has put itself as the person in charge of regulating this.
The FCC sure has. The other possibility, of course, is that Congress could act, and some in Congress vigorously opposed the FCC's action, and some in Congress supported the FCC's action. It may be an issue that comes to the forefront during the next election. President Obama, when he ran 8 years ago, promised net neutrality regulation. The next president and the next Congress may have a different view of how the communication law should work.
Do you think this is going to end up in the Supreme Court, or is it over?
If I were a betting person, I would say it's not going to end up in the Supreme Court, but I make it a practice not to bet on what the Supreme Court decides to do.
Northwestern University law professor James Spetta with us on Skype this morning from Northwestern, one of the law professors at Northwestern Law School and an expert in telecommunications law, talking about net neutrality.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It's 5:52. Welcome back to the program. On the WGN Market Desk this morning, Dow futures pointing toward a lower open on Wall Street, off 54 points now. The S&P and NASDAQ also lower. European markets hit the hardest, and Asia as well. Asia hit the hardest, almost down 3% in Japan. Let's get the latest on commodities now. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. In livestock trade yesterday, Midwest cash hogs traded steady to higher, as much as a dollar higher in the Eastern Corn Belt. In Illinois, steady to firm with a country top of $56 a hundredweight. Expectations of tightening supplies because of hot temperatures and higher animal feed prices, which could bring lighter weight hogs to market. So at the end of the day, October lean hogs at the Mercantile Exchange, $74.57, a gain of 77 cents. Grain market, yesterday was a red day on the screen. Wheat, corn, soybeans all lower. Wheat because of expanding harvest and extensive global supplies, and weather the factor in the corn and bean market yesterday. After going up last week because of weather, we started the week lower because of weather, with more rain than expected over the Midwest. And as one trader said, rain makes grain and warmer temperatures also help. One other note that we want to mention today, a record harvest crop for hops. Farmers expect to harvest 51,000 acres of hops in 2016. That's up 17%. And that is making the brewers of craft beers very happy, because they have been plagued with hop shortages. The Dairy Farm Breakfast coming up Saturday, Drendel Farm, Hampshire, Illinois, 6 a.m. to 11 a.m. See you there. Have a good day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You have a good day as well. Here's just a brief look at the day ahead on the economy calendar this morning. Labor Department reports on the number of people who applied for unemployment benefits last week. The department will also report on U.S. consumer prices for April. The Commerce Department reports on the U.S. Current account trade deficit for January through March. Also today, the National Association of Home Builders, Wells Fargo, releases its June index of builder sentiment. Freddie Mac reports on this week's average U.S. mortgage rates. So there's a lot of stuff that could drive the markets as we move through the morning. Most of these reports will happen right around the opening bell this morning.